and technology in our lives. Then throw in some culture, history, ethics, philosophy, and religion. That's Spark Dialogue Podcast, where it all comes together. I'm Elizabeth Fernandez. You've probably heard about it, the new gene editing technology that is taking the science world by storm, CRISPR. CRISPR is a powerful way to edit gene sequences that has applications from eradicating diseases to helping our crops. It's inexpensive and accessible, and this is causing CRISPR technology to move forward at a breakneck speed, perhaps faster than scientists, ethicists, and policymakers can debate and agree upon ethical positions. Today we are joined by Dr. Laila Jamal. Laila is a genetic counselor and has a PhD in bioethics and health policy from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. She also reported on issues pertaining to the ethics of CRISPR to the National Society of Genetic Counselors. So welcome to the podcast, Laila.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first, let's start off talking about CRISPR in general. So what is the technology that's behind CRISPR and how was it discovered and how exactly does it work?
Sure. So CRISPR stands for Clustered Interspersed Short Palindromic Repeats, which basically doesn't tell us very much about it. But what it is, it's basically the most customizable and versatile of the tools we have in our arsenal currently to perform gene editing. And basically, all the tools of gene editing involve the use of enzymes that are derived from bacteria, which are really part of the bacteria's native immune system. And these enzymes use different mechanisms to guide themselves to specific locations in the genome where they can actually cut human DNA and add or modify or delete our genetic information to put something new there. And so CRISPR came along, I think, most recently and is really exciting to people because it's much more precise and much more programmable than any previous method of editing the genome was. And really, it was just discovered by bacterial geneticists who've been working with these types of bacteria for a very long time and now have tools that allow them to really analyze bacterial genomes and viral genomes with much more specificity, and they're able to understand what's happening at the molecular level better than ever before.
And so I think it has a very interesting background, so how it was discovered. So didn't it come from understanding how a body reacts to an invading virus or something like this?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's really part of the bacterial immune system. So it's basically how bacteria protect themselves from invading viruses. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like the adaptive immune system of a bacteria that allows it to essentially target new DNA strands that it hasn't ever seen before and then alter them to, as a protective mechanism. And what we're able to do is we're able to hijack this system mm-hmm. and use it to insert whatever we want in order to modify an organism's DNA.
Okay. So you're actually cutting apart the DNA and inserting little bits of DNA within to change the gene in order to achieve whatever goal you want to achieve.
Right. So the enzyme that we borrow from the bacteria is able to introduce a double-stranded break in the DNA, and then through what's called non-homologous end joining, we're allowed to actually introduce new sequences that will manipulate our own DNA repair mechanism and incorporate new genetic information into that repair process. So it's kind of hijacking two existing systems, one from bacteria and one from our own DNA, and using it to introduce new sequences into our genome.
Okay. And so what is CRISPR being used so far in a general sense?
Right. So scientists and members of the public are very excited about these technologies because they enable such a wide range of different applications. So at the moment, gene editing is being used to develop disease therapies. It's being used to create novel cell lines or transgenic animals for research purposes. And these cell lines can be reproductive cell lines or they can be somatic cell lines. And we can talk a little bit later about what those terms mean. But the CRISPR system can also be used to modify gene expression or correct mistakes in genes that can cause them to malfunction. And it can be used to do something as simple as to fluorescently tag a chromosome or a cell material in a cell for research purposes. So people are very excited because there's a broad range of things that can be done.
Okay. So there's a lot of excitement in the last couple of years and a lot of research that's coming out that is using CRISPR because it is so accessible, it is so inexpensive. So what are some of the success stories you've heard of that are particularly exciting?
I think the first is there's been some promising preliminary data showing that CRISPR can be used to introduce a resistance to the HIV virus by targeting the receptors that allow cells to be infected by the HIV virus and altering them at the genetic level. Another promising application has been seen in trials that are focused on developing therapies for a disorder called sickle cell disease, where they're using CRISPR basically to prevent cells from sickling by deactivating the gene that causes baby hemoglobin to turn into adult hemoglobin. So normally when babies are born with sickle cell, they have normal blood cells that slowly start to sickle over time as they get older. And CRISPR can be used to introduce a mutation that basically blocks that process in affected individuals, preventing them from developing the sickle cell disease. And of course, this hasn't been done in human trials yet, but you know, there's early preliminary data showing that this could be feasible, showing proof of principle. And so that's what people are excited about.
So that's pretty exciting to think that there might, this might actually lead to a cure of HIV and sickle cell anemia.
Or not so much a cure, but well, in the case of sickle cell, maybe a cure. In the case of HIV, it would be almost a vaccine or a prevention measure.
Okay.
Yeah, because it would prevent the infection from happening. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So I guess the next step then is to think about some ethical considerations. So whenever you're messing with the DNA of plants and animals and even humans, there a lot of ethical issues come to mind. And so I guess the first issue that one needs to think about is there's two different types of gene editing you can do with CRISPR. And one is on the germline and one is with somatic cells. So how exactly are these two cases different?
That's a very good question. Somatic versus germline cells are very important to understand when you're thinking about the ethics related to this technology. So germ cells are the cells that are set aside very early on during embryonic development, and they're the ones that end up being eggs or sperm eventually. And so any genetic material inside germ cells, whether it's altered or not, it can be transmitted from one generation to the next. And by contrast, somatic cells are those that make up the rest of our body's tissues and organs. And alterations or modifications in these cells can affect the function of those organs and tissues profoundly, but they aren't transmittable to future generations in the way that germline modifications would be.
Mm-hmm. So basically, if researchers are working on CRISPR and they're modifying the germline and something goes wrong, then that's something that could be passed along through multiple generations.
Right. And so many of the concerns related to genome editing focus on uncertainties about its potential to introduce unintended changes to either the somatic or the germline cells. Mm-hmm. And especially when we were talking about germline modification, people get very concerned about the potential of this technology to introduce inherited changes to the genome, which could affect future generations of humans and alter the genomic composition of our species.
And so you mentioned unintended editing of the genome. So I think these are called off-target events, correct?
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. So what exactly is an off-target event and what are the chances of that happening?
Well, so off-target events are actually a really hot topic of conversation at the moment. What they are is basically scientists have recognized through preliminary data that when you use genome editing to target a specific region of the genome, there is this chance that your genome editing tool is going to accidentally insert a change in a part of the genome you didn't intend to, because there are many sequences in our genome that are repetitive and appear more than once in more than one part. Okay, and so if you've specifically targeted, a CRISPR-Cas9 intervention for one particular part of the genome, you know, we don't know for sure whether there's some other part of the genome it might bind to, because the genome is a wild and large, complicated place. And so while these technologies are much more targeted than what we've had in the past, we still don't really know how often these off-target effects are occurring, and we really don't know how to recognize them or evaluate them in a standardized way. You know, it would take quite a long time and quite a lot of research to really start to gather data about this, because the risk of off-target effects probably differs depending on the type of intervention you're trying to achieve in the first place. In other words, what part of the genome are you targeting in the first place? Some might be more prone to off-target effects than others. And so this is one of the issues that people are a little bit uneasy about, because this is really a core part of evaluating the risks of doing trials of this technology in humans.
Right. And so when you have an off-target event, what would that cause? Would it cause like a mutation in the cell?
Well, it's hard to know what it would cause, and that's part of the problem of the difficulty of evaluating it. However, you know, we fear that you could introduce a mutation in either, you know, the germline or another part of the somatic genome that would have health consequences for the individual, you know, the intervention was being performed in. You know, it might have long-term effects that are not visible at the time of the off-target effect occurring. So it's unclear, you know, how we would be able to tell whether a health problem in the future was attributable to a prior off-target effect or not. We just are worried that we could introduce problematic changes to the genome, as has happened in the past with other types of gene therapy trials, where, you know, the DNA has been inserted in the wrong place to negative effect.
Right. And I can see that if this is something that happens when you're modifying the germline, then that effect could be passed on to many generations, and it could have the effect of potentially wiping out an entire species or entire subspecies, and that could affect the entire ecosystem as well.
Sure. I mean, I don't think anybody is as concerned about wiping anything out, although certainly, you know, we need to be cautious and you know, we can't rule out dramatic effects, but I think people are more worried about introducing disease susceptibilities or, you know, malfunctioning proteins or, you know, messing up someone's metabolism or creating an oncogene, which might create, you know, a cancer susceptibility or things like that, that would just be so unfortunate and totally unintended and unforeseeable.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So CRISPR is being used a lot right now in modifying plants and animals, and I imagine there's a lot of different things we can do. So, for example, make a malaria-proof mosquito that's been talked about, or helping to make crops more productive so they can withstand drought or pests or disease or whatever. And so when you're talking about plants and animals, are there any ethical concerns that come to mind, that things we have to be careful of?
Well, I think many of the concerns are similar in the sense that we are not sure really how all the elements of our ecosystem interact with one another. And so when we start to tamper with one element, we don't know what the unintended consequences of that tampering might be. I think it's very tempting to use this technology, especially to, you know, help us attenuate things like malaria-carrying mosquitoes. But we've learned from, you know, prior experience that sometimes something that seems defective actually has a protective effect downstream in a way that's not clear to us, that, you know, right now, and later on it becomes apparent. So I think we're just a little bit nervous all in all about tampering with a complex ecosystem that we don't fully understand. But at the same time, some of the promise of this technology is really tantalizing. So it's a tough one.
Okay. So there's also been a lot of talk about using CRISPR to help with food production. Like I mentioned before, the crops to be more resistant to drought or to pests. And then I also heard about using CRISPR to edit chickens so that they make hypoallergenic eggs so that people who are allergic to eggs can eat them. So when you're talking about this type of thing and editing where our food comes from, should people be concerned at all with eating foods that are modified with CRISPR?
So I think this kind of links a little bit to the discussion we often have about genetically modified organisms in general. And there's definitely been some pushback against that tendency, especially in Europe. You know, there isn't strong evidence that this is really harmful. However, you know, once you start altering mammalian or other animal genomes, you know, we have less evidence and less experience to go on than we do with agriculture and plants. So I think where there's a lack of evidence, we should always be cautious. But, you know, we should also consider if there's a lack of evidence for harm, that we shouldn't write off solutions that could really help, you know, areas that have food shortages or agricultural production problems. This is something that we should probably keep on the table.
Yeah. So how do you go about balancing that? How do you go about balancing the potential ethical concerns or the fact things could go wrong with the fact that so many people could be helped on the other side?
Yeah, it's really tough. I mean, I'm a clinician, right? So I work with children and adults who have rare diseases. And so I really focus, you know, firstly on the risk to the individual. And of course, the risks, a lot of them are unknown when it comes to this technology right now, and they have to be balanced against the potential benefits, which are also kind of unknown. So it's really, really tough. And I think that's why we need to do as much basic science research, you know, so, you know, using donor tissue, not in live human subjects, as possible up front, so that we can really hammer out as much evidence as we can about this technology before we start using it in humans. I think that's going to be key, and that's pretty consistent with what the National Academies of Sciences in this country has recommended. But when it comes to germline editing, we've really got an even more of a conundrum, because we have to deal with the fact that unborn children can't really provide informed consent to have these interventions performed on them. And so, you know, in general, I think we need some pretty compelling evidence that this is going to be beneficial or helpful, and that there's a demand for the technology to be used in humans that is going to solve a problem that can't be solved in another way before we are willing to submit people to the uncertainty associated with it. But then, you know, we've also talked about the risks to society, and those are much harder to kind of get your head around, because they really deal with the appropriateness of altering the genetic future of the human race. And that's a really tough question to ask when, you know that individuals might benefit from doing so.
Right, right. And so in talking about using CRISPR on a human population, I know that some people have suggested a moratorium on human germline intervention. And so what are the policies right now that surround the human germline?
Right. So in the United States, we have basically a patchwork of regulatory bodies and oversight mechanisms that regulate what was formerly called gene transfer research or gene therapy research, and genome editing is now kind of falling under that rubric. And it really depends on whether the genome editing is occurring in a basic science research context or a clinical research context, and whether it's funded by the federal government or not. So, you know, if genome editing is occurring in a basic science context using anonymous or de-identified human samples, then it doesn't need to be reviewed as human subjects research by an institutional review board at your institution, but it probably will be reviewed by some kind of voluntary oversight body or an institutional biosafety committee. And that those were regulations that were set up quite a long time ago. But there's no federal prohibition on doing germline editing. It's just that basically Congress has stopped federal funds from being spent on germline genome editing and any kind of embryo research basically every year since 1996. And they basically appended a rider to the appropriations budget for the Department of Health and Human Services that says that no money can be spent that way. And so in effect, it's not the germline editing isn't really happening, but private funds can still be used to do it. And so that's an area where I think we might see more activity.
Okay. And is that something that we should be concerned with, that it is still happening even though it's not funded by national institutions?
Well, I think there are some mechanisms that industry firms will self-impose in order to make sure that basic safety standards are met. We don't know that these will be standardized, and we don't know how stringent these standards will be. However, if any of these companies wants to bring a application of germline genome editing to market, they'll need to go through the Food and Drug Administration, which also at this point has said they won't entertain or review research involving intentional modification or destruction of embryos. So right now, there's only so far that even privately funded research can go in the United States, but that could change at any point in time. And so I think we need to maybe not be concerned, but certainly be vigilant that this is going to go forward in some way, shape, or form, and most likely will happen, and that may actually become approved as a therapy, or at least reviewed as a therapy by the Food and Drug Administration if and when they ever change their policy. So there is no outright prohibition from the federal government on doing this at this time.
Right. And then also, if you look at the world in general, I mean, there's, of course, research going on in many different places. And so if a time comes that people decide as a community that, yes, we should put some sort of regulations onto what's happening, how do we go about that? Who is in charge on an international level?
Right. And that's a very good question. And I think that's been the source of a lot of concern and discussion recently. So most recently, you know, the National Academy of Sciences has just commissioned a year-long study, including input from stakeholders around the world, to try to create recommendations that scientists will voluntarily adhere to around the world, kind of based on the rationale that they were all involved in helping develop these recommendations. And so there's some hope that there will be harmonization coming out of that effort. They've just released a report based on that work that they did over the course of 2016. However, you're right, there is no internationally enforceable kind of set of regulations that every country has to adhere to. And there, I think, inevitably is going to be variation in what's available and what's allowed to move forward from one country to the next. And I think that inconsistency is going to be the source of a lot of confusion in the near term.
Do you have any recommendations for how to deal with this?
I think that ultimately, if scientists really want to be able to share data and collaborate and have their results be interchangeable, then they have an interest in adhering to similar operating standards. You know, I don't know if there are ways that journals can maybe come up with some criteria of what they will and won't publish based on ethical standards that the scientific journals decide to adopt. I mean, that's another way you might be able to get at this. But I think ultimately, you know, people will do what they're going to do. And it's I'm hopeful that, you know, most scientists are guided by ethical principles and are trying to do the right thing. And the ones who aren't, you know, will eventually gain a reputation for that, you know, that might be disadvantageous to them in the long run.
One of the worries, of course, is for when CRISPR is being used on humans, that there might be unintended effects. We talked a little bit about this before. So sure. Have we seen some of these unintended effects in other organisms?
So I'm honestly not aware. I mean, I know that there have been studies showing that there have been off-target effects. For example, there was a concerning paper that came out, I think, in 2015 from Sun Yat-sen University in China, which basically showed that when they tried to use CRISPR-Cas9 to alter a specific gene in an embryo, they found evidence that they had modified other areas of the germline genome unintentionally. Basically, everything that could have gone wrong with that experiment kind of did go wrong. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, although this wasn't in a living organism, it definitely was pretty compelling evidence that this is something that the scientific community should take seriously and develop more evidence about before they proceed.
And so another thing we talked about a little bit is consent. So obviously, if someone goes in as an adult and they have some sort of disease and they go for treatment that could be from CRISPR, you can almost think of it as taking a pill or getting a shot. They consent to getting treated for the specific disease. But things might be a little bit cloudier when it comes to children or people who don't have the consent to the treatment, like maybe criminals or even unborn babies.
Yeah, I really think that that is a concern, especially because so many of the conditions that CRISPR shows promise for are single gene disorders that are quite severe and quite rare and have few alternative therapies available for them. So take, for example, Duchenne muscular dystrophy is a degenerative muscular condition that's genetic, that affects mostly boys in childhood, and it's progressive and there's no cure for it at the moment. And, you know, there's some optimism from mouse studies that gene editing might be helpful in restoring muscle function in at least mice who have an analog of this condition. And that would be wonderful. But when it comes to doing trials, you'll have to do trials in children because this is a condition that affects children. And it's really unclear whether, you know, the evidence of off-target effects will even be apparent in them until years after they've been in the trial. Also, you know, any child who enrolls in a trial like that will probably have to forego other treatments and other therapies in order to be eligible for the gene editing trial. And so it really raises some questions about decision making and whether children can adequately assent to taking on those uncertainties and those risks. I think it puts parents in a really tough position.
There are people who have been concerned with using CRISPR to make designer babies or to using CRISPR to enhance athletes or enhance people to be smarter or stronger or whatever. Are these logical fears that people are having?
Well, you've raised a really important distinction that we haven't talked about yet, which is this distinction between disease treatment and enhancement, right? And so, you know, there is absolutely a really prevalent concern that, or at least question about whether genome editing is or should be used to enhance human traits beyond what is necessary to ensure their health. And so, you know, if it's possible to improve muscle function in children with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, why might we not also use it to enhance muscle function in athletes, right? I think, the technology begs that question. And I think these questions raise really thorny issues and really nuanced questions about our conception of what's normal in the first place and what constitutes the line between treatment and enhancement, right? I mean, there may be some ways that we could confer increased resistance to disease or longer term muscle function in aging people or things that would be considered probably salutary and good for us, but then, you know, at what point are you performing enhancement is one question. And I think a second question is, how equitably would those types of interventions be distributed in our society? And would they ultimately lead to this kind of stratified society in which we had enhanced genetic people and non-enhanced genetic people who would be the people who didn't have access to the technology? So I think it's what we call in bioethics a little bit of a slippery slope argument. And it's kind of hard for us to figure out right now where the line between treatment, prevention, and enhancement all kind of falls out. So I think there's going to be a lot of public engagement and public discussion about those issues in the future. I don't think we have the answers today.
Right, right. Do you think there's any ethical issues that we haven't covered yet that we should talk about?
So there's just one that comes to mind. And I think, again, it comes to mind because I'm a genetic counselor and I work with mostly rare disease patients. And it's this issue of when the National Academy of Sciences came out with its report on genome editing, they tentatively supported germline genome editing, provided that we get more data and evidence about its efficacy and safety, and provided that we only use the technology to prevent the transmission of really serious diseases. And I think, again, this is going to cause a lot of reflection and dialogue in our society about what constitutes a serious disease worth preventing. Because there are many people who choose to live with physical or other types of differences, and their families choose to accommodate those differences, and they feel absolutely fine about living their lives, in a kind of non-neurotypical or a non-hearing way. And there are other people who I think really feel quite strongly that they'd like to prevent the development of those traits in their children. If a disease becomes something that you can edit out of existence, that the existing individuals who either choose to have babies without using genome editing or who have no access to the technology, who have babies who are born with these conditions, will have more social stigma and fewer resources and support services available to them if this becomes something that wealthy people with access to technology are able to edit out of their kids. But these kids, other families may not be able to do so. And so those kids will still exist. And it will become, a strange world in which some of us are preventing these children from being born and others are living with these children day to day and trying to get programs and services for them. And I think it will stratify our society in a strange way unless we're careful about how we go about it. And so I think if we are going to eventually open the door to using germline editing, we're going to have to develop as a society a really kind of consensus process for understanding which conditions are acceptable to prevent using germline editing and which ones are not.
Yeah, I think that's a concern in all of healthcare, to have this difference in what level of healthcare people are receiving based on income or based on where they're living. That could be dangerous.
Sure. And I think ultimately how families handle their pregnancies and what interventions they're comfortable with is really a matter of personal choice. And there are some people who really feel very fundamentally ethically opposed to tampering with embryos and gametes. And they feel like, they should allow nature or God to kind of decide what happens. And so even if they have access to the technology, there are some people who would not choose to use it. And I just feel like we need to be ready to have a discussion about the legitimacy of those choices either way, because, it would be a shame to have genome editing suddenly become something that people were expected to do just because it was available.
Right. That's a very good point. Okay. Well, in that case, thank you very much for joining us today on the podcast.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
This is Elizabeth Fernandez for Spark Dialogue Podcast. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, head over to sparkdialogue.com/love and see ways that you can share the love and help this podcast grow. And we'd also love to hear from you. What do you like about this podcast, or what would you like to hear more about? Finally, you can find us at sparkdialogue.com, on Twitter at sparkdialogue, and on facebook.com/sparkdialogue. As always, thanks for listening.